The outcome of the 1824 presidential administration, presidential election, was that John Quincy Adams became president, and as we've seen in the so-called corrupt bargain, he turned around and appointed Henry Clay, the supposed kingmaker in the House of Representatives, to be his Secretary of State. Clay seemed to other potential presidential aspirants well positioned to become John Quincy Adams' successor. And so for that reason, and because of the way that this 1824 election had been concluded, they took a significant step. Senator Martin Van Buren of New York, Thomas Ritchie of Richmond, Virginia, who was the editor of the South's and perhaps the nation's most important newspaper, the Richmond Inquirer, and John Calhoun of South Carolina, the Vice President of the United States, organized the Democratic Party with the mission of ejecting John Quincy Adams and Henry Clay from the head of the executive branch. This is today's Democratic Party, founded in 1824 with the goal of getting rid of the Adams administration and to do what Martin Van Buren long thought of as opposing the Hamiltonian tendencies of its opposition. So as far as Martin Van Buren was concerned, there was an ongoing effort, even with the death of the Hamiltonian Federalist Party, there was an ongoing effort to resuscitate Hamiltonian principles and have the federal government lead the nation's economy through legislation intended to favor particular interests and particular industries. And as Clay said in his 1824 American System speech, to move 500,000 men off of farms and into factories. So with the organization of this new opposition, John Quincy Adams' administration got off on an extremely poor footing. In fact, Calhoun, as vice president, took advantage of the rules of the Senate to organize the Senate as hostile to Adams. The rules of the Senate said that the presiding officer would appoint members of Senate committees. This rule had been adopted by the senators in light of a long-standing tradition of non-attendance at Senate proceedings by the vice president. Typically, then, the presiding officer would be the president pro tempore, a senator who had been selected for this position by his fellows. But the first day of the new Senate in 1824, Calhoun showed up and appointed opposition majorities to the major committees. There then was howling by the Adams administration's friends in the media, the print especially, but it was too late. And already Calhoun had proven to be the best placed opponent of his own president. So this reminds us of the quip by the editor of the Calhoun Papers, Clyde Wilson, that John Calhoun was one of the few vice presidents in American history who were not important because they were vice president, but vice president because they were important. Calhoun had a freestanding base of support himself, and he was one of those people who intended eventually to succeed John Quincy Adams as president. And so the Clay Adams administration got off to a very weak start. In fact, Adams seems to have been relatively unconcerned with the fact that opposition was brewing. In his inaugural address, he said several things that sounded like Henry Clay plus. Not only did he endorse the particulars of Henry Clay's American system, a protective tariff, federally funded construction of roads, canals, and bridges throughout the country, and the ongoing support of the federal government for a congressionally chartered bank, but he also proposed various other measures that seemed to traditionalist Jeffersonian Republicans to be constitutionally dubious. Among other things, he said that there should be a national university. He said that the Congress should sponsor construction of what he calls a lighthouse to the skies, which is another way of saying an observatory. He said that European countries had observatories, but there wasn't one in America, and so Congress ought to fund one. In fact, he also said in his inaugural, Adams did, that the people who were hearing him, meaning members of Congress, should not be palsied by the will of their constituents. It may be then, in other words, that the American people would oppose this program, but so what? Do what you think is a good idea anyway. This, of course, brought down hoots of laughter from and scowls of chagrin, alternately, from Republican opponents of the Adams administration. The Adams administration was essentially thwarted at every significant pass, and it was unsurprising that in 1828, the Jackson men, who thought that their man had been cheated out of the presidency in 1824, now reinforced by Calhoun supporters and with the party organization that Van Buren in particular had taken the lead in constructing, were going to push their man Jackson for president again. Actually, the presidential election campaign of 1828 is one of the truly embarrassing episodes in American political history. The slogans of the victorious candidate, Andrew Jackson, were something that anybody who is supportive of the idea of Republican government ought to ponder with a little bit less than relish. So, for example, on one hand, you had the Indian fighter Jackson, whose mind, as one contemporary put it, was not the small kind that could only find one way to spell its possessor's name. In other words, Jackson didn't spell his name consistently from one document to another. And on the other hand, you had the president, John Quincy Adams, who had been active in the American diplomatic corps in his teens in Europe, who spoke several languages, who knew the Tsar, who had grown up with the founding fathers and had been educated at Harvard and so on. And so the Jackson men made an advantage, made a virtue of this contrast with the slogan, Quincy Adams who can write, Andrew Jackson who can fight. So if you were a voter, you were supposed to prefer Jackson on the basis of, well, our guy's marginally literate, but at least he's killed a lot of Indians. And on the other hand, that's certainly better than some guy who's been to Harvard and grown up in high influential positions in the federal government, and not to mention, as we saw in a previous lecture, having been the most successful Secretary of State in American history. Jackson was a soldier, Adams was bookish, and as his inaugural showed, he wasn't really that concerned with public opinion. He also was a bit, shall we say, eccentric. If you lived in Washington, D.C. while John Quincy Adams was president and you were of a mind to do so, you could go at a particular hour of the afternoon every day to the Potomac, where you could watch the president taking his daily skinny dipping excursion. Anyway, the outcome of the 1828 election was not surprising. Jackson won an overwhelming victory, and this was the beginning of what historians have long since called the Age of Jackson. Martin Van Buren, who was, again, a senator from New York, one of the organizers of the Democratic Party, and ultimately kind of the brains behind the Jackson operation once Jackson became president. That was especially true in the wake of a rift between Jackson and Vice President Calhoun. Martin Van Buren lived into the 1860s, and at the end of his life, he wrote a memoir in which Van Buren described the Jackson administration. Now, people very commonly purchase biographies of Andrew Jackson. Usually not a decade goes by there's not a best-selling book about Andrew Jackson. He's, of course, on the $20 bill, and every year the Democratic Party around the country has a Jefferson Jackson fundraising dinner at which supposedly the great American president is commemorated. But usually these studies and these commemorations omit what Martin Van Buren, Jackson's right-hand man and kind of eminence grise of the Jackson administration, called Jackson's greatest achievement. According to Martin Van Buren in his memoirs, the first point among Andrew Jackson's domestic policy was, quote, the removal of the Indians from the vicinity of the white population and their settlement beyond the Mississippi. So Jackson became president in 1829. By the time he left the White House in 1837, there were only a few hundred Indians east of the Mississippi, those basically in Tidewater, Virginia, and scattered areas in upstate New York. Other than that, what had been a population of about 3 million people east of the Mississippi in today's United States when Columbus arrived in 1492 had been reduced to virtually none. And this was largely a result of Andrew Jackson's policy initiatives. It was Jackson who requested in 1836 that Congress adopt an Indian Removal Act. This led to what has been remembered ever since by the Cherokee Indians as the Trail of Tears, in which Indian men, women, and children were made to walk essentially in winter from Georgia to Oklahoma. This is a very long distance today. The weather can be very severe, and unlike now, of course, in those days, there weren't any paved roads, there weren't any roads at all. So by some estimates, as many as half of the Cherokee starved or froze to death on this route, but Jackson didn't much care. So people had elected Jackson to high office in Tennessee in the first place with the promise that he would be an Indian fighter, and that's what he had been all his life. He was violently anti-Indian. And this, again, as Martin Van Buren said, was his main achievement as president. Let's accept Van Buren's testimony. Jackson had essentially a 50-year record of extreme violence against Indians. The second major event or series of events in Jackson's 8 years as president was what people then, in a sense, have called the Bank War. What happened there was that Jackson decided that the Bank of the United States had been used in a way that was politically partisan, and that the branch banks in some of the states had given campaign support to anti-Democratic Party candidates. And so, in 1832, Jackson, seeing an opportunity, acted against the bank. What happened was that in 1832, Clay, always angling for election to the presidency, went to the president of the Bank of the United States. The bank had been chartered in 1791, and its chartering in 1791 had led to a contentious dispute, first in the Congress and then in the cabinet, between in Congress James Madison on one side and on the other side the Federalists, and then in the cabinet Thomas Jefferson essentially echoing Madison's arguments on one side, and supported by Attorney General Edmund Randolph, whom we've seen playing a key role both in drafting the Constitution and in ratifying it. And on the other hand, Alexander Hamilton, the Jeffersonians had argued that the bank's charter was unconstitutional because there was nothing in Article 1, Section 8 that said Congress could take such steps, and there was an underlying principle of the Constitution that Congress only had the powers that were listed essentially in Article 1, Section 8. Beyond that, Jefferson actually quoted the language of the then-pending 10th Amendment to say this principle is understood to be underlying the Constitution. In fact, soon it would be made explicit, as had been insisted by people who were skeptical of ratifying the Constitution at the time of the Constitution's ratification. So President Washington signed the bill chartering the bank anyway, and again, in 1811, the bank came up for a recharter, and it was allowed to die. It was effectively killed off by Vice President George Clinton, formerly the governor of New York, and by that time, the vice president. In 1816, a second Bank of the United States was chartered at the request of President Madison, this time apparently giving up his old principles, although he insisted that he was actually just acting on the basis of precedent, which he said had changed the equation and made chartering banks constitutional. Most people didn't, well, certainly most Republicans didn't find this very persuasive, but in the wake of the War of 1812 and with the vanishing of the Federalist Party, a lot of Republicans just took for granted that this was acceptable. Anyway, in 1832, Henry Clay went to the president of the Second Bank of the United States and said to him that he ought to request recharter. Like the first bank, the second one had been given a 20-year charter, so an 1816 charter wasn't going to be up for a recharter in 1836, until 1836. But when the president of the Second Bank of the United States, Nicholas Biddle of Pennsylvania, pointed this out to Clay, Clay responded, well, okay, here's the thing. If you ask for recharter, we'll pass such a bill out of Congress, and then Jackson will have a choice. Either he'll veto it, well, either he'll sign it, in which case you have 20 more years, or he'll veto it, in which case he'll be very unpopular. I'll defeat him for president, and then we'll pass a new bill, I'll sign it, and you'll have 20 more years. So either way, this is a winner for you. And Clay thought this was possibly a way that he could get himself into the White House. Well, what happened was that Biddle agreed. He requested the charter. The bill passed. Jackson vetoed it, and contrary to Clay's expectations, Jackson took a step that was basically unprecedented. He, in a veto message, described not only his constitutional thinking in vetoing it, but also the sociological and political pressures that had led him to veto it. He said that the bill was unconstitutional because Congress had no power to charter a bank. He said that he knew that the Supreme Court in McCulloch versus Maryland had ruled that Congress did have power to charter a bank, but that in taking the oath of office, he had not sworn to uphold the precedents of the Supreme Court. He had sworn to uphold the Constitution. And where the Constitution and the precedents of the federal courts seemed to him to be in conflict, it was to the Constitution that he had to adhere and not to the precedents of the Supreme Court. So he did not have to follow, he said, McCulloch in that instance, because it was not a particular legal case, but was a question of policy making. So he was free, as he explained, to exercise his own judgment concerning the Constitution and veto the bill. The other argument that Jackson made had to do, as I said, with sociological and political considerations. He said that what this bill amounted to and what the charter of the bank had been operating under amounted to was just a transfer of wealth from everybody else in the country to a few well-situated, well-connected, wealthy shareholders. Basically, the way the bank worked was that the law said that all of the tax revenue of the federal government would be deposited in the bank. So it was effectively a guarantee to the shareholders that they were going to make money. How could one run a bank with all the federal tax revenue in it and not make money? And as far as Jackson was concerned, this was simply unfair. Besides that, he said, there were foreigners, besides the well-connected people that he had already mentioned among the shareholders, and there was just no reason to think that such an institution was intended by the people who made the Constitution. He said that government didn't have to be a curse. It could be a blessing if, like the heavens, it shared its blessings on rich and poor alike. But where it seemed to have singled out individual, well-connected, wealthy people and simply conferred favors upon them, he said the typical husbandman, the common mechanic, had reasons to complain. So he vetoed it. Well, this unprecedented argument, because the first six presidents had all agreed with George Washington that the veto power was about empowering the president to enforce the constitutional limitations on Congress's authority and not about political considerations. But this unprecedented argument that Jackson made in his bank bill veto message made him very popular. It was widely circulated. People who supported Jackson's presidency printed tens of thousands of copies and gave them away all over the country. And soon enough, what this did was to solidify the lines between Jackson's supporters and opponents in politics. To Clay's consternation in 1832, when Jackson was up for re-elections, he trounced Clay for president. This is en route to Clay's becoming the single figure in American history who lost the most presidential elections. Now, as this was happening, Jackson, of course, needed to have come up with some alternative to the Bank of the United States as a depository for the federal tax revenue. And what happened here was essentially, it seems, he had not thought out the way this system was going to work after the bank disappeared. He was angry with the bank manager, or I should say the bank president, Biddle. But what he came up with as an alternative were simply what opponents of the Democratic Party were going to call pet banks. That is, state-chartered banks in all the states, all of which were run by Democratic Party operatives. And what happened here was that what formerly had been a relatively constant availability of credit managed by Biddle throughout the country became a very uneven pastiche of banking practices from one state to the next. Besides that, Jackson's next move was to order his Treasury Secretary to take the federal tax revenue out of the Bank of the United States. One Treasury secretary ordered to do this told Jackson that although he agreed with Jackson's argument about both the Constitution and the political behavior of President Biddle, it was illegal for him to take the money out of the Bank of the United States. The law chartering bank had guaranteed that the money would be put in the bank, and the Treasury secretary was the one responsible. So Jackson fired him and appointed a different man Treasury secretary who also proved unwilling to take the money out of the bank. Jackson fired him too, and the third fellow whom he ordered to do this was his attorney general, now elevated to Secretary of Treasury, Roger Brooke Taney. This is a name that's going to be very important in American history. Taney, told by Jackson to take the money out of the bank, responded essentially by asking him when. And in return for his having performed this function for the Democratic Party despite the law, ultimately, Jackson rewarded Taney by appointing him Chief Justice of the United States. This was a very momentous appointment, as will be made clear when we get to the 1850s. Anyway, the behavior of Jackson here in removing the money, putting it in pet banks, and then he issued a specie circular saying that from that point, not banknotes, but only gold or silver should be accepted by the federal government in payment for Western lands. This, along with some foreign factors, some overseas economic developments, led to a precipitous contraction of the economy at the very end of Jackson's administration. Ultimately, the chickens were going to come home to roost when Van Buren became president. The third significant development of the Jackson years was what's called the nullification crisis. The nullification crisis centered on the implementation of Henry Clay's American system. As I mentioned earlier, one facet of Henry Clay's three-pronged American system was a protective tariff. Now, notice the word protective. Of course, a tariff is a tax on imports, and a protective tariff is one that is intended to protect domestic industries from foreign competition. So in other words, one might decide what level of tariffs to impose by saying, all right, what are the expenses of the federal government going to be next year? How much do we need to tax imports to gain that much money? And so here's the amount of taxation we're going to impose. That would be what people in the 1820s and 30s called a revenue tariff, tariff that was imposed just to get the money, to get the revenue. The other kind of tariff would be one such as this. America doesn't have a heavy industry because domestic industries can't compete, supposedly, with British, German, Italian, French ones. And so Americans are importing these goods. How much is the difference between the prices of the American goods and the prices of the imported ones? And how much of a tax would we have to impose so that the imported ones would be at a price disadvantage compared to the American ones? All right, we'll tax things that much. We'll tax things, in other words, on the basis not of the amount of money we hope to get from the tariff, but of the intention to drive American consumers to stop buying Wedgwood China from England, for example, and start buying China manufactured in the United States. And that's what Clay favored. Well, in 1824, at Clay's instigation during the presidential campaign of 1824, in which Clay was a candidate, and that was the year he'd laid out his American system in his famous House of Representatives speech, in 1824, Congress passed a tariff. It was a new, higher protective tariff. In that vote in the House of Representatives, not a single congressman from south of the Potomac River voted for the tariff, and it passed anyway. So a lot of people in the South said, well, this is highly problematic. This is actually vaguely akin to the situation we had with the British before the Revolution. People north of the Potomac are going to be able to tax us, and there's nothing we can do about it. We can all vote against it, and still it passes. So it doesn't matter what our opinion is in this part of the country, we're going to have this tariff imposed on us. And you might think, well, so what? But the thing is that in the 19th century, the tariff was largely a tax that fell on the South. It was disproportionately a tax paid by Southerners because the way the economy worked was that American exports were basically agricultural products produced by slave labor in the South. So if the tariff was going to be a major source of federal revenue, and if it was going to be used protectively to help, industries in Massachusetts, Pennsylvania, and Ohio, which is mainly what this was about, then people in the South were going to be seeing their money transferred from them to people in the protected industries and people who own protected industries in the North. They objected. They howled. They wanted a new president. They wanted to get rid of Adams and Clay. It worked. And yet in 1828, the tariff was raised from the rate of the 1824 tariff, 33%, to a new higher 50%. Imagine what your purchasing habits would look like if suddenly every imported item you bought had a 50% tax on it. My guess is that you would cease buying imported items. And on the other hand, if your whole state, such as, for example, South Carolina, were basically devoted to producing rice for export, it wouldn't be immediately obvious what you might substitute for that. So this was a problem that seemed a growing difficulty for people in the South, and especially the Deep South, where the economies were overwhelmingly, well, the populations were highly enslaved. South Carolina was still about 60% slaves when this was going on, and where the economies were overwhelmingly agricultural and geared to export. That means that basically everything these people were going to buy beyond rice was going to be imported. People in South Carolina in particular thought that, well, in 1828, their man was going to win the election. Their guy, Calhoun, was one of the organizers of the campaign. Now the tariff would come down. But through Jackson's first term, that just didn't happen. And in fact, at the very end of his first term in 1832, Congress adopted a new tariff law, setting new higher rates on particular enumerated items. So in other words, you might have a general tariff rate of 50%, but then you might say, and then when it comes to these particular kinds of goods, we're going to have an even higher specific rate on those. At that point, Carolina politicians decided, all right, we have to take steps to stop this from happening. And the answer they lit upon was what they called nullification. The idea of nullification had first been broached in 1798 by the legislatures of Virginia and Kentucky in what were called the Virginia and Kentucky resolutions. Those resolutions then yielded negative commentary from several states north of Virginia and Kentucky. So in 1799, Kentucky adopted a clarification of its position, and Virginia in 1800 adopted a report explaining why not only it thought the Virginia resolutions of 1798 were correct, but the entire Federalist administration of the federal government in the 1790s had been on a constitutionally unacceptable path. However, while the Kentucky resolutions of 1798 said that in case of adoption of an unconstitutional and dangerous federal policy, a nullification is the rightful remedy, they didn't say exactly how a nullification would work. And what happened in the 1820s and 30s was that the Vice President, John C. Calhoun, spelled out his understanding of how a nullification would work. His argument, which he laid out in what's called the Fort Hill Address, and then in the South Carolina Exposition and Protest, was that in case the federal government adopted a policy that was unconstitutional and dangerous, a state might call a convention of the same kind that had ratified the Constitution by having a popular election throughout the state for delegates to this convention. The convention, when it met, would be the sovereign people in the same sense as the ratification conventions had been the sovereign people in the late 18th century. And the sovereign people of a state then, as the sovereign, would have a right to say what the Constitution meant. They could say that authoritatively because the people of each state was one of the creators, was one of the parties to the Constitution. Now, as Calhoun explained it, in case a state did that, the other states would have a choice. If three-quarters of them disagreed with the nullifying state, then the nullifying state's interpretation of the Constitution would be rejected. If the nullifying state's interpretation of the Constitution were rejected, the nullifying state would have a choice. Either it could accept the Constitution's meaning as elaborated by the other states, that is, it could accept that its position was incorrect, or, on the other hand, it could leave the Union on the basis that it had never agreed to this different understanding of the Constitution and was not going to live under the Constitution if it was going to be read the way the other states had said it should be read. Again, once a state nullified, it took three quarters of the other states to gainsay what the nullifying state had said. That is to contradict authoritatively what the other state, what the nullifying state had said. Now, what was it exactly that South Carolina was contending? South Carolina was contending that the protective tariff was unconstitutional. Article 1, Section 8 said that Congress had power to regulate trade with foreign countries, but the nullifiers insisted that, well, the idea of giving the federal government power to levy a tariff intended only the power to levy a revenue tariff, not power to levy a protective tariff. As it happens, this is incorrect. People like James Madison intended in the 1780s, by adopting the federal constitution, precisely to give the federal government power to levy protective tariffs. They had various reasons for wanting to do that, not having to do so much with domestic social engineering of the kind Clay had laid out in his American System speech. I'm going to remove 500,000 men off farms and into factories. But what Madison had in mind was more allowing Congress to respond to foreign countries' hostile tariffs by adopting countervailing tariffs to encourage those foreign countries to remove their hostile tariffs. So anyway, as it turns out, the nullifiers were wrong about this tariff power, and there had been no distinction made at the time of the Constitution's ratification between revenue tariffs and protective tariffs. In any event, that didn't really get to the question whether a state had a right to nullify. And in 1832, after the tariff was raised again, as I mentioned a few minutes ago, what happened was that the South Carolina legislature called for elections to a nullification convention. Those elections were held, and more than two-thirds of the delegates who were elected to South Carolina's nullification convention were pledged nullifiers. When the convention met, it adopted a nullification ordinance, saying after a certain date at the beginning of 1833, the federal tariff could not be collected in South Carolina. If you were going to hold office in South Carolina, including on federal juries, you were going to have to take an oath to support the nullification ordinance. And what that was going to do was make it impossible for the Jackson administration to prosecute people in federal court for trying to thwart enforcement of the tariff. Right? How are you going to prosecute somebody in federal court for enforcing the nullification ordinance if all the jurors have to swear that they support the nullification ordinance? Well, when he heard about this, President Jackson issued his nullification proclamation. And what he said there was, nullification is treason. You South Carolinians have been misled by your politicians, but I will enforce the tariff, whatever South Carolina decides to do. At that point, it seems that Jackson was thinking about using the military against South Carolina. And in fact, in South Carolina, militia units were drilling all over the state, weapons were being bought, new militia units were being organized, tens of thousands of men were on foot. And what people didn't know at the time was that the governor of Virginia had decided that in case the president tried to march the U.S. Army across Virginia to get to South Carolina, he, the governor of Virginia, would oppose this with Virginia's militia. So this sounds vaguely like something that was going to happen about three decades later. Calhoun did not want this to happen. Calhoun's position within South Carolina was that of a moderate. It happened that many, many people in the South Carolina political elite actually wanted to secede from the Union in response to the tariffs of 1824 and 28, besides 1832. They wanted to secede. And so as far as Calhoun was concerned, this nullification idea was a moderate idea. It sounds extremist in the context of the federal union overall. What, you're going to try to nullify federal statutes? But if you were in South Carolina and the choice most people wanted to make was to leave the union immediately, and you said, oh, no, we don't have to leave the union immediately, what we can do is this, then that was more moderate. And actually, Calhoun was decried, his influence was regretted by secessionists in South Carolina through his whole career, because he was always a break on the impulse in South Carolina to try to leave the Union. Anyway, when Jackson made this proclamation, Calhoun went and talked to Henry Clay. There was a majority, actually, in the Senate, the U.S. Senate, of people who would have liked to reduce the tariff. If you took the Democrats and the Calhoun supporters, Calhoun had about six senators in a kind of nullifier caucus. If you added them to the Democrats, they were a clear majority of people against Clay's opposition Whig party. The problem was that Jackson had instructed his Senate supporters, the Democrats, not to talk to Calhoun about some kind of compromise. So that left Calhoun only one choice. He had to go talk to Clay about a compromise. And what happened was that Clay and Calhoun worked out a deal by which the tariff rate would be reduced 3% per year for 10 years. So this year it's 50, then comes 47, 44, 41, and so on. And Clay also pledged that in case this legislation were adopted, he would not work to raise the tariff for 10 years. So this would be the only tariff legislation that would be adopted. This was agreed in the Senate. It was agreed in the House. It was signed off on by President Jackson. At the same time as this had been going on, that they also had adopted in the Congress what was called a force bill, which would have empowered Jackson to use the military against South Carolina. Basically, it said that he could use force to enforce the tariff, and everybody knew that meant against South Carolina. Calhoun and his supporters stood in the cloakroom while the vote was being taken in the Senate on this. The only person who voted no on it was a senator from Virginia named John Tyler, who at the same time quit the Democratic Party because he insisted, as most Virginians did, that the president did not have the right under the Constitution to use force against the state. So while he disagreed, Tyler did, with nullification, as most Virginians did, even in the political elite, where they were staunchly in favor of state rights, still, Tyler was going to lead the Democratic Party over the idea that Jackson wanted to use force against South Carolina. Well, after the adoption of the Clay-Calhoun Compromise, then it seemed that the crisis was over. All that remained was for the South Carolina Nullification Convention to reassemble, to rescind its nullification ordinance, to nullify the force bill, and to go home. So it was kind of cheeky of them to say, we're not going to allow the force bill to be enforced in South Carolina. Besides that, people said that the nullification had been a success. Whether it's a success, I suppose, is in the eye of the beholder. It certainly did not make the federal government bring down the tariff very quickly or very much. 10 years, 3% a year, that was not much of a plan for reduction. But it was a kind of face-saving maneuver for South Carolina, and certainly it was a way to avoid what Clay wanted to avoid, which was a civil war. On the other hand, Calhoun recognized in the wake of nullification that this could not be repeated. That is, that there could not be another instance in which one state tried to stand up to the federal government. And so after the end of the nullification crisis, Calhoun would decide that what was really needed was to organize the South generally to defend itself in federal politics against the overwhelming might of a northern majority. And so he spent the rest of his career saying that nullification had been successful, but trying to organize the South more broadly to resist what he took to be a tendency to adopt anti-Southern policies, particularly in economics. But then it was also going to be increasingly clear that there was at least some group in northern politics that wanted to act against the interest of slave owners. And that is really the idea that Calhoun is most clearly associated with in American history. In 1837, we've seen ultimately Jackson left the White House. He was succeeded by Van Buren, who by that point was vice president after Calhoun had resigned the vice presidency. Van Buren was chosen to succeed him. And it was kind of poetic that it was going to be Van Buren who had to be there when the chickens of Jackson's ridiculous bank war behavior with the pet banks and the specie circular and so on came home to roost. And ultimately, Van Buren, like the Adamses, was going to be a one-term president. And this was chiefly because of economic events that occurred really before he became president. Actually, one historian, prominent historian, Jeffrey Rogers Hummel, has argued that Martin Van Buren was really the most libertarian president in American history. And his libertarianism consisted chiefly of opposing attempts by the Whig Party to institute the American system as a response to the economic contraction of the late 1830s. They insisted that borrowing and spending and public works and so on would bring the country out of recession. This seems to be a siren song that Americans are always willing and ready to hear, but Van Buren was the one break on this tendency during his presidency, he insisted that this was unconstitutional, likely would be counterproductive, and if there was an economic contraction, the country just had to ride it out, which actually many economists now would say was accurate. But it didn't do Van Buren any good, as people in the 1830s, like their descendants of later generations, have often appreciated the idea that at least if the president was doing something destructive, at least he was doing something.